Tuesday Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation, and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, social justice, or the Catholic Church. Today, my visitor is Professor Thomas O'Loughlin, or in short, Tom. Tom, a very warm welcome, and hi to my radio program.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Beate.
Tom O'Loughlin is originally from Dublin, Ireland, and is an ordained priest and professor of historical theology at the University of Nottingham. He is currently visiting New Zealand, where he has been giving presentations on different topics on liturgy. And, well, there are so many ways of, Tom, there are so many ways of celebrating and being Roman Catholics and practicing our faith. Some people go to Mass once a week. Others are involved in charities and social justice. And then there are others who are involved in devotions and devotional prayers. What is the background of devotional prayers in the Catholic Church?
Well, of course, all human beings have some awareness of the divine, though they may not name it as such. And the moment one becomes conscious of the divine, one seeks to interact with it. And prayer is that interaction. And so prayer is found in virtually every human society. So when Captain Cook came here over 200 years ago, he notes all the different religious observances he sees here. And that's a sense that we often forget, is that human beings are almost incurably religious. Even if they're not very obviously religious, or even if they say they're not religious, there is this somehow sense that there's something larger, there's mystery. And once you actually say there is mystery, you seek to address it. And it's that address that's prayer. Where Christian prayer comes in is that Jews and Christians and Muslims would say that there is a dialogue between God and the individual and between dialogue and the human family, and that dialogue takes the form of the invitation to pray. And so all three religions have had structures for prayer that are based around the day, based around the week, based around seasons, and then based around the year. So popular devotions are one expression of this very basic human reality. And they can be found in all the three great monotheisms, and they can be found in various forms among all the different forms and flavors and colors of Christians.
So it's almost part of human being to have that tendency.
Part of being a human being is not only to be aware of oneself and to be aware of the wonder of the people around you and the wonder of the creation, but something more than wonder, the mystery. And then to seek to put words on it, and then to be aware that the mystery is in relation to you. And this relationship evokes prayer.
And what about visionaries? Is that also something that the many religions have in common?
All religions have the notion of visionaries, and all religions have the notion of that somehow or other the mystery makes itself very consciously manifest. But it's curious that even if you take visionaries and very detailed accounts of vision experiences, they're a tiny fraction of human experience. But human beings often, far more widely, have just a sense that somehow or other the facts are friendly. And so religion is invariably optimistic. Mm-hmm. Religion is always seeking the idea that the universe is not only good, but it can be better. And so there's no disconnect between the idea of prayer and social justice. Indeed, to make a disconnect in either way is to fracture the human response to mystery. And of course, we all like a good story, and there is something attractive about the thing that is somehow out of the ordinary. Well, you would know with the phrase the Gansandra, this thing that is sort of weird and wonderful and over there. But actually, most human beings, their experience of mystery is the experience of the people they love, of childbirth, of spring, of the wonder of friendship. And it's these tiny little indicators that are far more precious to people than the one, than the sort of messages from the holy other, the Gansandra, that visionaries. Visionaries, in a way, can be a distraction from the day-to-day wonder, and visionary messages can be a distraction from the day-to-day practice of the love of God and neighbor.
Is there a certain approach from the Catholic Church regarding visionaries? I was just thinking of, for example, saints. Some of my favorite saints, they were not recognized in Vatican since 1969. They are not recognized as saints anymore. And they have lovely stories behind. So it seems like the Vatican does look at stories and at persons. Is there a certain thing that recognizes?
Well, there are some stories that are very noble. There are some stories that are not noble, and there are some stories that are just fraudulent. And the ones you're referring to are things like the story of St. Christopher, which is a, the problem is that when you lose sense of that there's a difference between something that actually has a historical basis, such as a saint, that you could know the date they were born and the date they were died, and a piece of pious mythology. If you start confusing those, then you're on a slippery slope where truth and non-truth become slippery themselves, and you get into the world of make-believe. And religion does not want to say it's just simply an account of facts, but equally it's not make-believe. The mystery of life is something greater than facts, not something that's less than facts.
Yeah, thank you very much. And for those of you who are listening, this is Muffin Talk. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tangaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Professor Tom O'Loughlin, and we've been talking about visionaries. And, well, some people, one of the topics that is in the world around at the moment is there are not enough vocations. There's not enough vocations to priesthood, not enough vocation for religious congregations, and others consider the lack of vocations as a new chance for the laity to be strengthened. What do you think?
Well, let's start with the notion of vocation. The notion of vocation is every human being has a vocation, and every baptized human being has a vocation within the church. I think one of the problems we have had over the last 250 years, roughly since 1750, is that we have been confusing the concept of vocation with very specific, very public ministries in the church. Every Christian has a ministry, and some people are needed to perform these very public functions. Now, the shortage of people to perform the public functions may be due to many sociological factors. It may be due to the fact that full-time religious work is not very attractive. It may be due to the fact that there are other ways that people think they can make a difference. And in the case of the Roman Catholic Church, it's certainly very closely connected with the fact that the most visible ministry, which is that of the presbyterate, sometimes inaccurately referred to as the priesthood, the presbyterate is reserved for celibate males. Now, leave that question aside, because for even if, you know, let's think of the audience who are listening. There are very few people who would even think of these very public ministries, and particularly that ministry of presbyter. But every Christian who is listening to this program has a vocation, and it's a vocation to be the presence of God in a particular place and to do a particular thing which no one else in the universe can do. In their world, they have a particular task and a particular calling, and the Holy Spirit is empowering them as much as he's empowering the presbyter in the church building on a Sunday morning. And the key thing is for each individual Christian to be listening for what is their unique calling and what is their unique challenge and what is their unique gift. And it's always a mixture of need and gift. There is a situation that needs addressing, and we all can't, no one can do everything, and you can't play all the instruments in the orchestra. So what you have to do is you have to try and figure out, well, here is a particular need, and this is a need that might only exist for a day, a week, a year, or it might exist for the whole of your lifetime. And then it's to see, well, what gifts have I that I can bring to this situation? And then there may be something else, that not only what gifts have I, but how can I improve those gifts? Because we all know that a gift is a great thing, but a little bit of practice really is wonderful as well. And a little bit of thinking, a little bit of learning can often take a natural skill and turn it into something really useful. So when I hear people saying, "Oh, we're having prayers for vocations," I hated to think that this is some sort of thing where we just want more presbyters, or we just want more deacons. I think what we want to be doing is we want to be praying that every Christian, every single member of the baptized, is tuning in more to this unique thing, that there's something that they can do, that that individual can do, that no one else can do. And then another aspect of this is I see in many Catholic dioceses there's a thing called the vocations office. And if I meet the person who's in charge of that, who's invariably a presbyter, and I say to them, "So you're the director of vocations?" And he says, "Yes." So I said, "Well, if I wandered in off the street, would you be able to help me to discern my own vocation?" He sort of looks at me. And what we actually need is to start thinking in terms of if there's a vocations office, it's to help this person or that person. Because often talking about vocation and talking about situation is the way you discover your vocation. And then when we've got lots of you, then the Catholic Church, well, it needs to address this whole question. In an earlier age, celibacy made sense in the Catholic Church because it adopted a very clear belief that there were two grades of Christian: those who were on the way of the commandments, and they were just ordinary people like my mother and father, and then there were those who were on the way to perfection. They were sisters and those who were presbyters, the clergy. And it was very much a two-tier vision of the world, and it was a two-tier vision of holiness. And so, for instance, no one would have thought in 1950 of putting the vocation of being married and looking after a family and building up the society of the family and the building as equal to the vocation of a presbyter. But of course, that is one of the great insights of the last 50 or 60 years in Catholicism. And one of the things that has to match that is, of course, the whole question of, we have to address again the whole question of compulsory celibacy. And indeed, one of the interesting things that's happening right now is that Pope Francis is actually hearing requests from places like South America, where there's a vast need not only for every Christian to hear their own vocation, but for these very public ministries. And where they're saying is, well, we know there are people there who have all the skills, and this can be part of their vocation, and if only this technical question were resolved, we would suddenly have lots more ministers. So that's, I see this as a time of, this is where the Catholic Church is at a crossroads. At the one hand, it has to rediscover vocation. At another level, it has to change some structural things. And it also has to remember that most of the Christian clergy in most of the churches, for most of the time, have all been married. Just, we think of the Greek Church, the Coptic Church, the Armenian Church, all of these churches. These are ancient churches going all the way back to the time of the apostles, as much as the Latin Church, and of course they've never had this discipline outside of monasteries.
Yeah, and I interviewed a bishop from Guatemala a couple of years ago, and he said without the laity he couldn't run his diocese, because the priests, they visit every day a different region and they travel so far. If they didn't have the people at the place and who spoke the indigenous languages, they would be prey to anybody else. But they are looking for spirituality and for this feeding of the gospel. And so in many parts of Latin America, what I've come across, they would go to an evangelical church, but to any church that gives them some kind of connection to God.
Oh yes, it's very interesting to watch how the human need for, we use this word spirituality, but we often don't know what we mean by it. What I would call is religious understanding and religious affirmation. That is a real need. And the evangelical churches, they have the logistics, they have the people on the ground, and they are able to fulfill this need. And that, I see that as a reminder to the Catholic Church that it is failing in a fundamental function of having skilled people on the ground to try and help people with this challenge of making sense of their lives in the presence of God, which would be another way I would translate spirituality.
Yeah. So everyone has his or her talents. And as in the Bible, with that story of the talents, you're not supposed to bury the talent.
Absolutely.
You're supposed to use it. And by using it in the church, for example, you might multiply it, because you might invest, help others, and they can contribute.
One cannot be genuinely religious in a universe that is created by a generous God and not make a difference for other people.
And you can't be on your own, because that's one of the preconditions in at least the three big, the people of the book.
Yeah.
They all, the Muslims, the Jews, and the Christians always say you have to, community is a big part of your belief. So when you're in a community, you're acting in community and you're reaching out.
Yeah, and of course for Christians, we're baptized into the community. It's baptism is an entry into the community. It's becoming part of the people of God. It's not merely a private sort of remedy. It's not sort of like a visit to the doctors for an inoculation, or to get some sort of tablets for a sickness. Baptism is a joyful occasion, because someone is given a name, and they're given a name within a community. That's one of the reasons why I like being called Tom, because that's the name I got when I entered the Christian community. I was all of 10 days old at the time, I should tell you, so I don't remember it. But I have been told it happened, and I'm delighted.
Yeah, in my tradition, often the parents chose names that were close to the saint day when you were born.
Yes.
So we've just had St. Thomas Day, so maybe...
Yes, I got my second name, which is John, from the day on which I was born, but I got my name Tom from my two grandfathers.
Well, is there any rule regarding baptismal names? I remember I talked to a missionary who was working in Africa, and he told me that parents sometimes chose very strange names, and he said, "No way, you can't use that for the baptism." So he explained to them. And
But when religion came to Ireland in the 4th and 5th centuries, they chose all the local names still. So we got a whole load of batch of new names like St. Kevin and St. Eunan and all of these. And then when religion went to Germany, we got a whole load of new names there. So just as we got a load of Irish saints eventually and a load of German saints eventually, perhaps if they used African names, they'll eventually get a load of African saints.
Well, no, I was talking about names that they just read and they didn't know what it meant.
Right.
Okay. So you have to be careful how you what kind of names you choose. But talking about baptism, and you say that everybody has a vocation the moment that they are baptized. And is there, is RCIA and all the programs to form a young Christian, are they supposed to help you in your finding your vocation?
That is actually one of the key points in the church's initiation programs, not only in, that was why they were originally thought up in the second and third and fourth centuries. And then we got into the habit of just baptizing infants very quickly. And part of RCIA is to make people aware that this just isn't opting for a religion, nor is it just something that is private and individual, which is how baptism has tended to be seen by all of the Western churches for the last 1,000 years. It is the rite of initiation. You are bringing someone into a community. You are bringing someone into a new way of life, and you are bringing them into a new awareness of who they are.
So that's really, and that's why the baptismal font used to be always at the
at the gateway to the church.
Yeah.
Yes. That you couldn't get in without passing it. And in theory, that was why you blessed yourself on the way into a Catholic church, because that was originally the baptismal font to remind you that you are there because of baptism.
Because that's something that in many other churches, when you go into the church, you don't have the holy water, and that's how you can recognize, for example, in Germany, you can recognize the Lutheran church doesn't have it. So when you see the holy water at the entrance of the church, you know that you're in a Catholic church.
Mm, yes. But in many of the Lutheran churches, you will actually find the baptismal font very near the front door. And if you look at well-designed modern Catholic churches, they won't have the font either away in a corner or up on a sort of a stage. They will have the font right at the main entrance, so that you can't go in without reminding you're passing through baptism.
And the baptismal font has always been part of the churches, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, as long as we've had churches, we've had baptismal fonts. And so, yes, and traditionally, they're always placed near the biggest door.
Yeah. And who can perform a baptism?
Anyone can perform a baptism. Every Christian can perform a baptism. Okay. Every Christian can perform. That's one of those basic rules that everyone is supposed to know.
Is it the same with other religions or with other denominations?
Oh yes, every. One of the few things that nearly all Christians are agreed on is that every Christian can baptize another human being and lead them into baptism.
And which denominations does the Catholic Church recognize as
We recognize the baptism of everyone who uses water and the formula invoking God as Father, Son, and Spirit that's found at the end of St. Matthew's Gospel.
Thank you very much for these explanations.
Thank you. It's been great fun being here on this very wet day in Auckland.
Well, by the time that it will be broadcast, maybe the sun is shining again.
Okay.
So never give up. And what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Center? On Monday, the 15th of July, we'll have our third session on Living Gratefully with Sister Helen Bergen. In this session, Sister Helen Bergen invites us to explore our particular place in planet Earth, and we will learn how to respond to God's wonderful gift of creation, including the rain. We need it. On Friday the 19th of July, 9:30 to 12:30, we'll have Margaret Bowater, who invites us to take part in a skill development program workshop on dreams. If you have never worked with your dreams and you're looking forward to getting a chance to get to know more, please note that Margaret Bowater will facilitate her introduction to Dreamwork, Dreamwork 101, on the 26th and 27th of July. Also on the 27th of July, from 10 to 1, we'll have our annual ecumenical event. We are picking up on the theme of gratitude, which is our overall theme for the year. Please note that this event will take place in St. Columba Center, Vermont Street in Ponsonby. And for all events at our center, please register with us per phone at Auckland 09-638-6238 or through our website at www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. And I wish you all a good Friday and a blessed week ahead. And thank you, Tom, for having come to the studio.
Thanks, Beata.
We're drawn within the loving heart of